Nerd Appropriate presents exclusive coverage of the BioWare base, recorded live at PAX Prime 2013.
All right, welcome to the Rated NA podcast for the website nerdappropriate.com. As you'll notice, this is not a numbered podcast. We're doing a whole special series for you.
Yeah, we're going to be bringing you a total of 12 different podcasts recorded live at the BioWare base this year's PAX Prime. So make sure to click subscribe and enjoy.
Welcome to the BioWare base.
Yay!
This is the 17 years of the development from Baldur's Gate to Dragon Age Inquisition. Also, Mark Dara is wearing an entirely too old, inappropriate shirt.
This shirt, this is a historic shirt.
It's vintage.
Is it 17 years old?
It is 17. It's from the first year of BioWare.
It's from a different millennium.
Yes.
Yeah, that's from an age when logos had to be gnarly.
Yes. See, this is a human hand, and this is a robot hand. You see, that's
Bio.
Because they're I think because they were doctors.
Yes. Yep. And the gastrointestinal patient stimulator.
Yeah, that was technically our first game.
Wait, so what is
that one? That's still one of my favorites.
For people in the audience,
it does say we're into anything geeky. It does in fact say that.
Yeah. That sounds like it could just one word, and we're into anything kinky.
That too. Yeah. I've got a version of that.
There was a logo.
Just look at his beard.
That's true, but I don't have. That was never on a shirt.
No. Well, yes, it was.
Oh.
Yeah, it was. It was a fist with glasses on it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That
nerd,
is true.
The nerd power shirt.
Yeah, like that.
Like it was angry?
I guess. It was or gnarly. it was just a well-educated fist. You don't know.
Okay, so we're going to go down the row, and everyone's going to list their names. I guess the title that they currently have, because it might get a bit confusing. And just the titles that they have worked on. My name's Jessica Marzen, and it's going to be pretty not exciting. I'm the community manager, and I've worked on Mass Effect 3 and Dragon Age Inquisition. I'm just moderating, so. Oh, God.
Jessica is working harder than any of us.
Absolutely.
I just like to say that.
No.
Way to go.
No, this is not about me. Let's
move
on.
For this minute, this is about you.
The entire community team who is backstage, like, wrapping up things in saran wrap to ship it out is working much harder than I am. I'm just wrapped in Morgan's skirt.
In Morgan's skirt, which is a bit dirtier when you say it out loud the way you look at it.
Can we do a round of applause to the community team?
Yay!
Okay. Thing about love, you can spread it.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I was wrong. Yes, it is going to go totally off the rails. Okay, I'm Mark Dara. I'm the executive producer on Dragon Age. I'm going to list everything more than I normally list. I actually wrote an install package for Shattered Steel that never got used. I wrote it before I started at BioWare. I was a programmer on Baldur's Gate 1, lead programmer on Tales of the Sword Coast, Baldur's Gate 2, and Throne of Ball. I wrote the DM client on Neverwinter Nights. I was lead programmer on Jade Empire. I was lead programmer and executive producer on Sonic Chronicles The Dark Brotherhood. I was Before that, I was briefly the stream architect on Mass Effect 1.
That was a typo on his business card.
Yes, that was spelled with a QU.
He wasn't the architect. He was the
architect, yes.
Like an old, loadable gun.
And then I moved on to be the executive producer of Dragon Age Origins, Dragon Age 2, and now Dragon Age Inquisition. Ooh, yeah.
I'm Mike Laidlaw. I'm the creative director for Inquisition, so lead design, all the design stuff. And I am a relative noob by comparison. I started just as KOTOR was wrapping up and told Brad Prince, who was the cinematic designer at the time, that Darth Bandon should maybe chuck a guy to the side or do something badass as he strode out to show he was pissed. So, you know, pretty profound impact on Star Wars. I think I have a special thanks on some of the expansions for Neverwinter. But the things I really worked on were Jade Empire. It was my first game. Luke and I were code lead writers on that. And since then, I moved on to Mass Effect, where I had the dubious honor of figuring out what those other alien races were going to be like. So that's where the Hollis, or the Volus, the Hanar, and the Elcor came from. Me and a fever. Recognizing the work I'd done and forcing translators to figure out how the hell the Hanar talked, they quickly moved me off that project. And I ended up on, ultimately on Dragon Age Origins, Dragon Age 2, and, well, here we are, Inquisition time.
Hooray.
Yay! I had to look it up because I'm old.
Because you're old. We're all old, Luke.
Yeah,
except for Mike Gamble. Because
yeah, I'm not old. I'm young.
He's a young one.
So I'm Luke Christensen. I was I'm senior writer at BioWare, and I was brought on to write BG1 back in the day, and I was on. So Baldur's Gate, Tales of the Sword Coast, MDK2, VG2, Throne of Baal, Neverwinter, Shadow of Undertide, KOTOR, Jade Empire, Mass Effect, Origins, Mass 2, the Lullian Song DLC, DA2, and Mass Effect 2, and something else buried in there. .. I don't know. I had to look it up in my SIG on the BSN, which is prefaced with "Nothing tastes better than ship cake."
So
that is true.
I think, you know, not to under or oversell this, but it's very important that the first Minsk, right here,
yeah,
written by Luke.
That's true.
Thank you.
And Boo.
I remember when I started, because I sat right beside a slightly enraged Luke, because it was crunch time for Star Wars, and realizing that I was sitting beside the guy who wrote Minsk. Oh, my God.
What was that?
Oh, my God.
And he just told someone to fuck off.
And he totally told someone to fuck off.
Didn't
yes,
you
it was a good day.
Song, too, on BG1? What was that song?
Back then, everybody did everything. So I did sound. I did generously called sound design. And I did Cerevox's death sound, like cobbling that together from stuff. And I did the TX rules.
Oh, TX rules.
That plays during
Make
the
way.
Credits.
Make
yeah.
way.
Because
so
I was
awesome.
Very, very tired one night and had access to SoundForge. And let that be a lesson to you all.
What is it? Little Monkey? Monkey
Little
hump?
Monkey Spankers.
Little
yes.
Monkey
yes.
Spankers.
I wrote TX too. He was fun.
Yeah.
Tiny
so,
little insane Pesci.
So Steve Gilmore, lead animator. I started back in 97. I worked on Baldur's Gate as an animator. I was the only animator on Tales of the Sword Coast. I worked as the lead animator on Baldur's Gate 2. I also worked on MDK2, Neverwinter Nights, Throne of Baal. I was the lead animator on Knights of the Old Republic. I worked on Jade Empire. I worked on Origins, Mass Effect, and Dragon Age 2, and the expansion packs, or the DLC that we did. And now I'm the lead on Dragon Age Inquisition.
Yay. That's a lot of stuff.
You sound very tired, Steve.
Getting tired just listening it, yeah.
It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, my name's Matthew Goldman. I'm currently the art director of Dragon Age Inquisition. I started in 98, and I worked on MDK2, doing concepts, UI, some level modeling and stuff. Baldur's Gate 2, got to work on that. That was awesome. Throne of Baal was my first lead position. Then we got to make all the creatures, beginning with R for KOTOR. That's pretty awesome. I did some tile sets and portraits and stuff for Neverwinter. Worked on Jade Empire and its astonishing sequel. And then I did some things. And come back to work on Origins, DA2, and Inquisition, which will be the best game ever.
Yay. Woo! I'm Mike Gamble. I'm a producer, and I've worked on Mass Effect. Compared to these gentlemen, I am totally a noob. They've been at BioWare for far longer than me. I started on Mass Effect 2. I was producer in Mass Effect 2, and I moved on to all the Mass Effect 2 DLC, except for Arrival, and then moved to ME3, was producer on ME3, producer for all the Mass Effect 3 DLC, except for Omega, and now I'm currently on the next Mass Effect game.
That took like, and sorry, we're out of time.
The end. Yes. I actually was thinking that would take longer, and then I was like, oh.
Well, because it's because Mike only had like 30 seconds. Like everyone else was like.
I was like, cool, and then I'll have 10 minutes left for questions, and then I don't have to prepare anything, and I won't have to moderate, and oh crap, I still have like 40 minutes left of the panel. Hey, Mark, do you want to moderate this one?
Do you really want that to happen?
A little bit.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question of Jessica to start with. Why don't you tell us about why you have a Band-Aid on your wrist?
No.
Do you really want me to moderate now?
Oh, fuck, I'll do it. Okay.
Jessica and I are having a little struggle with wills.
Yeah. Well, go answer her phone or something. While we're up here, I think probably the thing I'd be really interested in hearing is, since, again, I'm the relative noob, having only been there 10 years, in the early days, and there was this thing we called the old office. It was there may have been an older office, but the one we had that was above the chapters is where I started. And it was well above capacity when I started. It had, I believe, a hole in the wall where someone had tripped going up a flight of stairs and jammed his head into the drywall.
Is this the office where the elevator smelled like pee?
Well, yes. If there wasn't someone actively sleeping in it, because it was yes. warm, and thus they had peed. My favorite memory for the old office, and this will be the question, is what, you know, for those of us who were there, what were your favorite memories of that glorious hellhole? Was the Habit Trail. And it was.
You mean Bagatha?
Yeah, Bagatha. We also called it. So the best part was it was February in Edmonton, which is like the bottom layer of Dante's Inferno. It is fucking cold. It was -35. I remember coming into a room and our lead designer for Jade Empire looking at Luke and going, how you doing? And Luke looks up and goes, I'm making my own gravy. And we were literally a month away from leaving the office at this point, like getting out. The whole company was going to move to a new location. And so we had to figure out how to handle the fact the HVAC had just up and quit. And I guess since we weren't paying any more rent, they were like, let him cook. So by quit, I mean like the office was 38 degrees in the middle of winter. And I don't know how that happens, but it did. And so the solution to keep QA alive, not comfortable, but alive, was to take the one room where all the air conditioning was pouring out of one of those overhead fixtures and tape a bunch of blue recycling bags together to create this, like, Habit Trail tube, like a gerbil would run down, full of air that would just be gushing air into the QA room to keep it at least under 40.
Oh, no, there's lots of – I can add way more context here.
Yeah, good. Do it.
Additionally, we actually had those portable air conditioning units, not the ones you put in a window, but the ones that have, like, the tube. That you go that sort of sticks out the back,
which is supposed to go out.
It's supposed to go outside. Instead, we were pumping it into the ceiling, and so my favorite memory actually is that we were running three of those off of a garden extension cord that was hot to the touch. So I don't know why we didn't catch the building on fire. But here's the trick: despite our terrible, terrible landlord, our lease meant we did not pay for electricity. In that space.
for a company
suckers.
With like 7 computers per room. Yeah.
So
I'm going to go, it wasn't always above a chapters.
No, there is an older.
When we moved into that office,
that is right.
What was below was a bank.
A bank and if you recall, a barber shop training, a beauty shop training academy.
Well, yes, there was that. But they didn't have to jackhammer to take that out.
That's true. That is true.
When it became a chapters, they took out the friggin' vault.
Yes.
For like a week of just heavy, hilty jackhammering.
That is
so
true.
That's, you know.
So it's basically like our current office.
Yes.
which is just hammer drilling all day.
Yeah, running cables is different than destroying floors.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
I remember the first time I met Greg Zeschuk. So we'd been hired. I'd been hired. It all been by phone calls, and I was like first day of work. I think I have a job. I'm not entirely sure. But there were positive words said, so I assume that's the way this is going. I show up at 9 a.m. and there's no one there. The place is totally dead. There's one guy downloading porn, and that's it. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? He said, go get a coffee and come back at 10 o'clock. Okay, I'll go get a coffee. I come back at 10 o'clock, and I get inside, and this guy walks up to me, and he's barefoot in an office space. He's got super long hair and a Fu Manchu mustache. And he's like, how you doing? I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, okay, yeah, how you doing? He starts talking. It's Greg Zeschuk. And boy,
doctor,
medical doctor, who had a car that didn't go in reverse.
It didn't. Well, it did with he used his left leg.
Yeah, he pushed it up the door and
back
ran
when
it
we're you know, the good doctors were paying our salaries and we weren't sure how long we were going to last. He wouldn't fix his car. He just wouldn't do it. And he said, "Yeah, it doesn't have reverse." I'm like, "Who are you?"
So another fun one I usually find, everyone seems to have a pretty good story for this. And Mike, this one you can participate in.
Yes.
Yeah. Is your first, like when you first started, day one, you know, there always seems to be some memorable story, like someone you met or something that was, well, maybe someone was downloading porn. thank you for that kickoff.
Sorry.
Mike, any thoughts?
Oh, let me think. My first day was actually pretty intense when I came into BioWare, because I came here from EAC and they did things totally differently. So the first thing that I always remember was I was showered with swag. As soon as you get in, you have to get all the BioWare propaganda going. You got to like wear the bag to the mall. You have to wear the shirt to the mall. Everyone has to know you're working at BioWare, so they give you all that cool stuff. And I sat in a room with HR for like 3 or 4 hours, and they just walked me through how not to get fired. It was actually really, really, really intense. And when I finally got to my desk, I didn't have a computer. I didn't pretty much have anything. It was just like, well, here's your new job. Your boss is not the guy that we interviewed you with. It's just some other guy. You'll have to find him eventually. So welcome to BioWare. And I was off the deep end. And I think most people here had the kind of off the deep end approach to getting hired as well.
Can I tell my story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My first day, I think they, I guess someone wrote it in the calendar wrong, but when I showed up, everyone, no one knew that I was starting that day, so half the office was gone, and the other half was just like in meetings, so I came, and everyone was like, oh, are you sure that you're working here? And I was like, no, I am. And like a bunch of people knew me as a fan. And so like security came down and they were like, I don't think you're supposed to be here. And I was like, no, it's my very first day. And I'd like picked out an outfit to wear before. Like I had a backpack on. They were like, I don't think she's supposed to be. And I was like, no, seriously, I'm working for BioWare now.
At least you knew where the office was.
Wait, it's my very first day here.
Did we actually hire you? Have you just been faking it the whole time?
I'm an imposter. And so finally, I got up there, and they were like, oh, we don't have a desk because we didn't forget. We certainly didn't forget about you. You weren't forgotten about. But we don't have a desk. Also, we don't have a computer, and your IT's not set up, so you're going to have to use your Gmail. but no one's going to respond to your Gmails because it's not secure.
Right.
So why don't you just sit here? Here's a notebook so you can take down notes. But here's a BioWare notebook, so you can take down notes on BioWare notebook. Also, here's a training video about sexual harassment.
Because that's going to come up. That's the message that's sending, right?
Yeah.
You'll then need to know.
It was great. And then I got a plumb bob, and I felt a lot better.
How many people had to put their desks together on their first day?
I had a banquet table. It was very
you're
the lucky one. I didn't have a banquet table. I had the piece of the desk that's the addition to a desk. So it's just a drawer with 2 feet, and I had to like counterbalance my monitor on it.
Steve, I didn't have a chair. Did you have that weird funny shaped one with the two circles and the green thing in the middle?
No, I
had that as a desk for a while.
I had an old school banquet table. I worked on it for 2 years.
An actual folding banquet table.
Yep. Oh, nice. Yep.
Here's your desk.
Well, you didn't have to put it together. It just was easy.
Yeah, it was easy.
Fold it up.
I recommend it. I remember assembling mine. The HVAC had failed. There seems to be a kind of a recurring theme there. And yeah, it was like 33, 34 degrees. And it was like, all right, gonna put that IKEA desk together. I think it was one of the last people to actually have to assemble my own desk because Leon Korotash started around the same time as me and thought that was barbaric.
So it is barbaric.
It kind of was barbaric.
Do you know how many people, if you just tell them to put together a bookcase, put the back on backwards?
That's all?
Pretty much everybody. Yeah.
Isn't it like... the back's like textured totally different.
Yeah, but the thing is what your mental process is that it's facing down, so I want the colored side should face out, which is up, but it's actually not. You need to put it down. It's just basically people have a mental brain fart at whenever they're putting the back on a bookcase.
Some of us apparently.
Yeah. Well, you're an assembly kind of guy.
Yeah.
I've watched you build
picnic tablecloth clips out of paper clips with a pair of pliers. So there you go.
Rapidly.
Yes, like in like 2 minutes.
Had to be done.
Okay, so if the office had some kind of apocalyptic like meltdown, mm-hmm. who on this panel would be the most valuable person to have in your party? You can have two people.
So can I? I'm not allowed to add Richard Iwaniak to the panel first. So Luke, and for sure.
I'm gonna say Mike because there's some good meat on there.
There's good eating on the lead designer.
Wow. not because I grew up on a farm or anything and know how to grow crops and shit.
I'm thinking long term, but not that long.
Okay.
He's going to eat you. You have to grow the crops, and then he's going to feed you the crops.
That's right.
Fatten you up.
Yeah. That's the way it works.
So you're saying you can provide garnish as well?
Yeah.
Yes. And the rest of you still have to go.
I take Goldman for sheer stubbornness. I can't think of a person who would be more likely to stare down the apocalypse and just tell it to go to hell.
You could kill wildlife with scorn.
Yeah, exactly. Come on, dear. Yeah. And and Luke, definitely Luke. Like, the dude is a handy motherfucker. It's crazy.
Thanks.
You're welcome, hungry cannibal guy. Anyone else got survivors they want?
I feel
okay,
like we
so
should,
Richard
we
Iwani.
I feel I have enough enemies on the DA team as it is. I'm not going to ostracize myself.
We should probably talk about you. Actually the games that this panel is supposed to be about.
Well, I was thinking favorite thing that we worked on would
yeah,
probably be a really
gonna,
cool thing
I was
going to
talk about that. Yeah. Maybe not like I feel like probably you shouldn't pick favorites, but if you want to pick favorites, but maybe even favorite moments from or your favorites.
Sure.
You can pick favorite children if you want. I won't tell.
Won't you?
Will the
podcast
the people
tell?
Who listen to the podcast will.
Yeah. Because we're on podcast. Favorite moment for me? Wow, it's been a long time. There's something powerfully engrossing about working on a small team, and Sonic Chronicles had a team of only 23 people.
Tiny.
Yeah. That in a lot of ways will it has a great place in my heart, I guess.
Favorite thing I worked on. I love Jade Empire. It was a labor of love. It was hell on us. And it was a cool, beautiful setting, right? I mean, a lot of the people up here worked pretty hard on that damn thing, and it was tough. There were some really tough times, but I think because it had been such a hard road, when we finally saw it kind of crest the hill, we all got a little silly and giddy. And my favorite thing was at the time we were just figuring out how to do voiceover, right? Like we'd been figuring out like how to get that flow, because LucasArts had done it ahead of time, or Atari had done it for the earlier games. So we'd gotten our own pipeline down. We got a good director in LA. You know, I would spend, you know, for the major characters, I'd spend a big chunk of time on the phone with them. And we realized that for Sagacious Zoo, we had some extra time. Like, you know, it was going to be like, because they bill you for the full of like 4-hour sessions. And so I pinged Luke, and what ended up happening was, do you remember the credits for Jade Empire? Yeah, do you remember all the, like, you know, the actors talking as if they're actually the characters, but the characters have other movie roles? You remember all that stuff? Yeah, we did that on the fly. So Luke would be sending me IMs with these really goddamn funny lines, like, Air Biscuit, a championship racing dog who, a dog who rode a racehorse. That's right. So we just kept, doing all these.
Says a dog can't ride a racehorse.
I know, exactly. I know. And they're so light. They're great jockeys. You know, but Water's Edge, The Beach, Rage of the Nightmare, and so on. So all these awesome quotes just coming in and me basically reciting them to the actor who would pencil them down. Robbie and I came down to being the best goddamn sport about this whole thing, and then be like, okay, cool. And he'd read them back in like his movie trailer or behind the scenes voice. And then we realized that that was working pretty well, so we actually did it for real for later. But I'd never kind of been part of a live recording session in that way before. That was a blast.
You know, a lot of it is stuff that's terrifying at the time, and you look back and it's awesome. Like for me, that was the tail end of Mass 2 was wonderfully challenging and crazy and fun, because we had at a time when you're supposed to be ramping down, and you know, some people are coming off, some people are moving on to other projects, some people are moving companies and stuff. A perfect storm came together, and it was terrifying. There was one writer left to go to a different position. Okay, fine. Yeah, we'll compensate. You know, we'll spread it around. Another writer left to go to a different position. Okay, that's fine. Montreal opened up. We need people moving down there. A writer went down there. Now it's getting a little thin. Yeah. And then Patrick Weeks punched the planet to save a child. He fell on the ice at West Ed and broke his collarbone. And then that left me. and Mac. Mac was, but we were busy recording too. So for a very intense month and a half, here's Mass Effect 2. Oh, okay. Hey, this person's going for a recording tomorrow. This bug hasn't been fixed. We read it tonight. Okay, sure, done. Maintenance on this character has to get done. Okay, sure. It was blisteringly fast and terrifying. And you look back and that was, Wild West game design. Woo! That was fun. It was hard and painful.
Yeah, that was KOTOR for me. KOTOR is sort of my favorite. It's always the lead animator. And if you remember, I mean, Neverwinter Nights was the previous game that we had done, and they were piece-based characters. They didn't have fingers. Their faces were painted. They didn't talk to each other. They were just little tiny characters that, you know, interacted, but the camera was very far away. And then KOTOR was fully... phoneme recognition, faces that worked and emoted and spoke, lines of dialogue, fingers, articulation, and then there's the little thing of making lightsaber combat and trying to make it look good in a very short period of time with no IK, if you know about that. It was very difficult, and it was scary, and the first time we were going to E3, when we were going to announce the game, we had to have a live demo, and four of us worked on it for 6 weeks, and that was very terrifying. I worked every single day trying to get this thing to look like something that felt like Star Wars. There were a lot of terrifying aspects to doing that. And we actually pulled it off, and I believe we got Game of Show or RPG of Show that year at E3. And such a tiny amount of people, but, you know, very dedicated, very focused. And I just, you know, like, the combat was the thing I had worked on and made the interacting being able to use different kinds of lightsabers and all that stuff and have it actually work and interact correctly. And, you know, there are lots of things that didn't go well, but, yeah, we were pushed really hard, but I think we delivered. And, you know, it's a game I'm really proud of, actually. So.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
In that demo, what happened if you pressed spacebar?
you jumped and you had Kurt's parachute pack open up. from MDK2. So never jump.
Never press that space bar.
Don't press that button.
Also, the music was a separate file that you had to start at the exact same time.
Oh, yeah. Right.
It was like Dark Side of the Moon and Wizard of Oz, kind of. Okay.
Yeah.
We were just sweating bullets the whole time.
Yeah, every project. You think it's going to, you know what you're doing, you got it all planned out, and every project is harder than the last one. It's just when I started, I didn't know enough to know that this was really not a great idea. So, I mean, the first day story, that was pretty much the first 6 months of MDK, because that was at a point where I don't think anybody knew what they were doing. There were no roles. Some people knew how to do 3D. Some people knew how to program. And literally we were just randomly doing things with no design documents, and somehow it like started to form out of the mud a game. But yeah, every game has been incredibly challenging in some way or another. I can remember the end of virtually every game is just really brutal. Like, sitting there, I had a broken hand on Jade Empire. My hand was broken. And the HVAC was doing the opposite. I had to wear gloves. And I was trying to type bugs with my broken hand in a mitt. And that sucked. Yeah, 63 days in a row, I didn't see the sun. It's like we're shipping in 2 months and we haven't started the end bottle.
We should make that.
Yeah.
Sounds important.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think my favorite... One moment, a very Canadian moment, is we finished Baldur's Gate 2. You know, there was the schedule. I had to make a level every 4 days for 12 months. And we did it. And we went out on the balcony. We had those little gazoos. And we were like, woo, we did it. And the people from the scream therapy place next door came out and gave us shit.
Oh, yeah.
For making noise.
Oh, just for context. Noise. There was a scream therapy place beside our...
It's 3 p.m. Yes.
I forgot about that.
$100. That'll be $100.
I've never even heard about that. That's
that was,
amazing.
That was, yeah, wow. That's right. That's why, if you remember, Ray and Greg's offices had the double doors.
Right.
That wasn't soundproof for them. That was for the scream therapy place.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so after we briefly office. Celebrated, we went, sorry, and went back inside and started throwing a ball.
So you were bothering the screamers.
Yeah, we were bothering them.
So for me, I think, there were a couple that really stand out in my mind, but and they're both kind of related to DLC. The first one is right after we released Lair of the Shadow Broker for ME2, because kind of leading up to that, we were, you know, the DLC thing had been done and not done so well, and, you know, there was a lot of talk about quality in DLCs and things like that, and as a team, we had a big team at that point in time. We sat down, and a lot of these stories, you know, a lot of the stories that I've just heard, they come out of like, I was happy because I worked my ass off for 3 or 4 months and I didn't see sunlight, and then it came out and people were happy. And then that's kind of like the best redeeming feeling. So that's the way it was for Lair of the Shadow Broker. When we put that out, we really weren't expecting kind of the reception that we got from the fans in terms of how much they loved it. So the whole team was just like elated, and for me that was one of my my happiest moments. The second one was for the extended cut. When we finished it, it was this really somber, interesting moment amongst the team. We were all there for, you know, 30 days. As soon as we announced it to when we shipped it, literally no one left the office. It was that kind of situation, because we all wanted to put it out and make it good. And I think when we had our final review, Casey and myself were kind of sitting in the office, and Parrish was going through the final cinematics. And when, you know, kind of like the final note hit on the final beat of the extended cut before it goes into the still frame stuff, everyone was just kind of like, yeah, okay, that's really what we wanted to do. And, you know, we just wanted to get it out at that point in time. So for me, regardless of how it was received afterwards, because people loved her, people hated her, whatever, that was I think my favorite moment so far. So
I just want to say there is one visual that still sticks in my mind that's kind of one of my most favorite things that I remember about BioWare was Mark Dara accepting an award from Snoop Dogg. Yeah. During the Spike music.
That was like your Twitter
two worlds cut.
That was my Twitter profile picture for a while, yeah.
Now your Twitter profile is a picture of you and Mike, but you cut Mike out.
I did cut him out. I don't need him. he's on my Twitter header thingy.
That's fine. I don't really care.
Yeah. You care a little.
Never
bit.
Liked you anyway. You're not Chris Bane.
That is true.
But you know who is?
Chris Bane.
Yeah.
Everyone, round of applause for Chris
Bane.
You're
my boy, Blue.
Chris Bane, everyone.
There's gonna be lots of people online going, "Oh yeah, I get that.
Yeah,
I get
that
from the last one." Yeah.
Well, we should probably take some questions. While our Q&A person is coming out, I have a Band-Aid on my hand because I was doing risky business on my hardwood floor and I fell. And no one asked me, but my favorite moment game that I've worked on in my short time that I want to share with people because I know there's a lot of hopeful people out there has so far been Inquisition because I started back when Inquisition was still Exalted March, and it has been really exciting because I started with working with Felicia Day and doing Mark the Assassin, and I've been getting a lot of pings from very early on the Parch project from Mike being like, "Hey Jess, what do you think about this thing?" And we'd have long conversations, blah blah blah. So it's been really cool seeing some of those conversations in the game. So all of you out there who want to work in the industry and be these folks, don't give up on that dream. You could do that. And then someday wear a 17-year-old shirt.
I'm disappointed that no one else on the panel thought this was important enough to specifically pack a 17-year-old shirt.
I don't fit any of those things. Thanks for rubbing it in.
So if you have any questions, raise your hand and David will come and find you.
This is for Mike. First, I just want to say the Citadel DLC was probably my favorite video game experience in the last 5 years. And the previous one was probably KOTOR. So the Citadel DLC was just really heartwarming and hilarious and touching. And so great job on that. I also really like the extended cut ending. I am curious, I don't want to get too much into controversy or anything, was that extended cut ending in the works before the game shipped, or was it a reaction to the controversy? Because it seemed like, oh yeah, this is clearly what they meant to do in the first place. But I'm just curious.
No, it wasn't actually in the works. We shipped the game, and you know that was the ending. And then, obviously, it wasn't as much the controversy, it was as much as like the people had spoken, and it was more about that. Yes, we were going to do something else. Yes, we were going to make more. And then we began work on it. And that's kind of why it was like, yeah, we didn't see the sun for 45 days. Because as soon as that decision was made, Casey and Ray and Aaron and all those guys kind of were like, no, this is absolutely something that we want to do. Then it was like, all right, we got to do this, and we got to do this as best we can and as soon as we can. So, and in terms of Citadel, yeah, I mean, I was just one part of it. All the writers, designers, artists, everyone on the team. We had a much like Shadowbrook, we had a really, really good team, really big team for Citadel, so I'm glad you liked it.
Hi, guys. I'm a big BioWare fan. I enjoyed Knights of the Old Republic. And I really enjoyed that. That was the first experience on BioWare. Basically, it got me encouraged into making games. I'm trying to get into that business. In a design process, when you face a roadblock or you just lose that little directive, what do you guys do to refocus, or what do you just go play a different game, or what do you do to recharge?
Exercise. And sleep. Sleep is good.
Yeah, sleep on a problem, take a walk. Like, get, you have to get your head out of it, right?
Yeah.
And whatever it is that distracts you is vital to getting a new perspective. Or go ask someone else, like, okay, so here's the thing. What would you do? And those are often where the best results come from because you come at it from a fresh perspective.
Yeah, I mean, these are beasts that can take years to make. So a good chunk of that, you don't see what you're doing. You're building something into the void, and how good it is not going to emerge, or how bad it is, or anything is not going to emerge for months. And sometimes I need to go make something, so I'll go home and beat something together, nail it together, make something. I don't know. I need something tangible in my hands, and then I'll go play games. You know, like because we're all gamers. That's,
yeah.
We're making the games we want to play because we want to play more games.
You definitely have to keep your hand in because if you become too inward-looking, that's not a good way to be from a design perspective.
Yeah. Yay.
You answered that. Nailed it.
I was wondering, how do you, like, over the breadth of a large amount of games, and especially when you're releasing multiple games over a very short period of time, how do you avoid, like, redoing things? Like, the Reapers and the, I can't remember the undead semi-creatures, the corrupted guys in Darkspawn.
Yeah.
Thank you. God, I'm a moron. Anyhow, they're pretty synonymous as far as origins go. So I was wondering, how do you make that decision to do that, and what decisions do you make to avoid doing that?
It's tricky. I mean, like, you know, we're dealing with you know game after game. On the writing side, we've had literally millions of words of content. You know, there's going to be repeats. It's going to happen, but it's a matter of finding that angle. On it. It's not the most important thing to be completely original every single time, because that's not how creative things work. They build on history, and whether it's our own history or whether it's other people's history, it's finding that angle to it. And you know, my trite little phrase, well, you know, it's if it's done bad, it's cliche. If it's done right, it's archetype. You know, and the only difference between those two is I liked this one. You know, there's no difference. So it's just a matter of you know, going out and looking at new things and adding that to the pile that you draw from.
I think doing the same old thing is really tough. Like, it's hard. You generally want to do something fresh. And, you know, if you're playing games and looking at what the landscape looks like, you can usually find a hole. Like, this hasn't been done. Nobody's seen this before. It's what keeps me going to work, is that I can make new stuff and explore new spaces. Because if I'm just doing the same thing, I don't want to do that. That's not what I want to do.
Yeah, pre-production for any game is a lot about exploring kind of the things that we want to do in the next game, but the things that we don't want to retread. I know that we're going through a lot of some of this stuff with the new Mass Effect game as well, and we're just kind of thinking, well, what familiarity do we want to add, but what kind of fresh takes do we want to make things so that it doesn't seem like it's the same? It's a challenge. Everyone on this panel has gone through it a million times.
I think something that's really important to remember as well is that you know, while there can be similarities, you know, and when you're dealing with, you know, epic adventure, there tends to be a big threat. That big threat, you know, threatens to overwhelm, destroy, corrupt, or pervert everything you hold to be true and right. And that kind of theme is going to keep recurring, right? And you tend to see that in most fantasy. But, you know, if that's all it is, if that's all your game is, then it's missing the heart and it's missing the soul. And I would put forward that, you know, the heart and the soul of say, Mass Effect, right, shines through in something like Citadel, you know, which is not really a story about the Reapers. It was a story about Shepard and a story about friendship and how that's really important. Right, and that's what we do ideally, is create a space that's robust enough to support not just world-ending threats, but also like genuine affection and a kick-ass party.
Karaoke.
Yeah,
I mean that's. I think that came out of Joss Whedon or somebody. It's the way to get interesting stories is you take interesting characters and hurt them. And so the same hurt to different characters gives you something different. And the player character is what is just another character to hurt.
So I am actually a designer in the industry, and John Arrhenicus was a character who really resonated with me as a villain. This is mostly to the writers and designers, but anybody feel free to answer. Why, first off, who are your guys' favorite villains, and why do you think we don't see villains of that magnitude anymore? They do show up, but not quite as powerfully.
Well, he was awesome because he was voiced by David Warner, for one thing. And also, he had I painted that cod piece. That's another reason. Yes. Thank you for enjoying that.
My first desk had like a 10-foot tall Arrhenicus on the wall, like boof, right there. So it was just cod piece all the time. It was just a titch intimidating, Matt. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hold on. We need to talk about villains.
Go ahead.
Oh, Mel.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, honey. I have a question when you're done.
Okay. Villains?
I think villains are really difficult to do well because you have to both have a motivation that you can understand with the villain, plus they need to be really terrifying. And that combination is really difficult, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in Origins, that was done by, you know, breaking it out. It's like, okay, you've got a major threat, but that's not really the villain. The villain is this human weakness that's going on in the background that you have to contend with before you can fight the big bad. You know? And that's a theme that continues in all the Dragon Age stuff. So, you know, finding that character is difficult because he has to be understandable enough and reasonable enough that you get it, but unreasonable enough that he is the monster that keeps him apart.
Or she.
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah, because Arrhenicus, I mean, he'd been stripped down. He'd been rendered less than what he was as far as he was concerned. And I think a big part of it actually is when the art team is really in sync with that story and understand it as well. There's something that Matt and Matt Rhodes do exceedingly well, but character artists and the whole crew do, is, you know, with Arrhenicus, right, you know, the fact that his face had been pulled back in that kind of extreme facelift, and if you know his history, right, he was once immortal, and of course he'd been using the life-extending magic, so it's just sort of like, wow, cool, that's this twisted manifestation of almost an excess of the 80s and 90s, right? I assume we just do it better now. But that sense of like, wow, he'd become inhuman, and it had a physical and visual component to it as well. Though, funnily, and I'm a little biased, but Luke did almost all the work on him, is Master Lee is my favorite villain of the ones that I've worked on. Because he had all the mustache in the world he could possibly twirl, but you could just see where he was coming from. And because you'd had that relationship with him first, right, you'd actually had time to get to know him, and he was like kind of like your virtual dad, and then all of a sudden, well, bam, and you're like, you dick. You know, and because of that interpersonal relationship, I think he was one that really resonated for me as the betrayal ran way deeper. So I thought that was
pretty powerful. Glad that he could persuade you, and you're like, yeah, you know what? Your villainous plot is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, that third ending, man. Yeah, wow.
The glorious moron ending.
Yeah, I think designing the villain is like, of all in the hierarchy of fun things to do, that's got to be the top thing. Because you only get to do one per game.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay, can I ask me?
Okay, you can ask your question now, Mel.
Okay. I've actually been curious about this for a while from you guys, but maybe it's an awkward question in some ways.
Commando.
You guys have kind of grown up through the industry.
Boxers.
I'm going to drag it off the rails. If it's not going to go off the rails, Jessica, I'm going to get off and I'm going to pull it off.
I'm getting you for that later. You guys have grown up through the industry, from younger men through into fathers, into those times when maybe you were having your wife have a baby during crunch. Sorry, honey.
Yes.
Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe
so
someone was having an
interview.
I know what
that was
interview.
Like for us. And I'm actually curious about the rest of you and how that affected how you made games before and after, not just in the hours and how that all juggled, but actually more like, did that change the decisions that you made to put in the game because you were a father before and after?
I think it has for me. I think it's changed my perspective on a lot of things. But in terms of from a work perspective, yeah, it has. I mean, it's pretty hard to stay at the office until 9 o'clock at night when there's a 3-year-old at home and a 1-year-old. But this is still a hard-ass industry, so you try to balance it as best you can. You know, modeling up here, Jesus.
Yeah. I think we've done. I think the company's matured and gotten older, and compared to the definitely what I went through on Jade, but what the horror stories I hear from the old BGs and stuff is that we've gotten way better at managing crunch, way better at you know weekend work and stuff. And I think we're at the point now. Certainly, we've seen this on Inquisition where there's already been some crunch periods. But it's always been, I think, for a specific goal.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like, well, we're going to be on stage at PAX, and we had people staying. I remember one of the programmers. I think Jacques. How long had Steven been with us? Like 2 months.
Mashmeyer.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a really new programmer. Really young. Really keen. He's just like, I'm going to get this thing working. And he like. For tactical camera, you guys were at the panel. You saw the whole yeah. We were expecting to show way less of that, but he was just like, "I'm putting features in and just nonstop because he wanted to, right?" And that's the thing is working towards a goal, working towards having it shown has helped, and as opposed to just like these like Jade. I think there was a good 7, 8, maybe 12 months where it was just like late nights and weekends nonstop, and it was a death march.
And the endless pizza of BG2 from BG.
Yeah,
that was
random the bucket of fried chicken every day for 3 weeks. I was like, seriously, come on. What the hell is this? It's like candid doctors? Camera. It's like stop motion is that you get greasier and like more shriveled and more horrified.
That was Ray and Greg's idea of variety, and the food they brought in late at night was different pizza every night.
I remember shrimp and pineapple. That was
weird.
I'm pretty sure Ray just... He tells me, he swears to me that he didn't even conceive of the fact that there were other places that you could get delivery from.
I'd believe that.
So I'm trying to start a project myself, and I have no idea what I'm doing. And I was wondering how you handle when you start a project or pre-production. Like, do you get together and speak out ideas or drop a design document or even maybe start with a prototype? Or maybe just a branching timeline about how your story is going to take or how you're going to spread out your development.
Mike, you're in this process right now.
Yeah, all of those things, actually. Yeah. I mean, like, what we're kind of going through right now is the folks that have the good ideas all get together and hash those ideas out and fight those ideas out, right? So if you have something that you're extremely passionate about and you kind of table it in front of your peers – and get their feedback on it, and you can either defend your idea, take their feedback, incorporate feedback, kind of build your idea up from there. And once an idea kind of gets to that point where you want to do something with it, build a prototype. Don't spend a lot of time, but build a prototype and make sure that, you know, that thing can be shown or presented to your peers and you can all see how it feels. After that, then if the prototype is great, then go forth and make awesome, because then that's when the real hard work starts. But in the beginning, you want to make sure that you're continuously building things to kind of validate some of the cool ideas that you have in your head. It's kind of cliche, but, you know, everyone has really cool ideas. I mean, we all do. It's the ones that you're open to challenge and you're open to iterating on and changing and kind of making into something that's really special that a group of people can support. Those are the ones that live the longest. That's just my take.
Well said.
I think we have time for two more questions.
I have a question mostly for the guys who worked on KOTOR, but, you know, anybody else that wants to answer. Did you guys have an opinion or, like, were you fans of Obsidian's work with KOTOR 2? And are you disappointed that story focused on, you know, Revan and their relationship to the Exile from the second game that Obsidian made didn't really get to be explored after the sales of the second game?
I don't know. You all, We'd change our own stuff if we could. Of course, we have opinions on how we would change other people's stuff. Holy cow, yeah. But that's not my job. I don't know what they went through to get to where they are. And I have to appreciate it the same way you guys do. I have to look at it and go, you know, what did they manage to do? I have a perspective maybe that's can be a little more understanding of the troubles that come out of, you know, like of things like that, just because I understand the process that goes into that. That layer of knowledge can ruin games, though. Like, you don't kind of want that. You have to parse that out in order to still enjoy things, because you start to see the matrix behind it. It just sucks fun out of it. But if that's a case where you're just happy to see it continue, because we found ourselves in a place where we couldn't do it. We had to take our you know, what we wanted to do in a different direction. So having it still live on was great. And then, you know, that allowed it to eventually come back. You know, and we did get a piece of it back. You know, with Swedar. So it's just to see something that you make just continue on beyond you is all you can ask for, really. Mm. You
know. And you know, if we continue to make KOTOR, you wouldn't have Mass Effect today. I mean, that's just the way it is. That team, all the genius minds behind KOTOR, for the majority of them, moved on to Mass Effect. But they just wanted to do something fresh, something new. And then, you know, a bunch of other folks moved on to lend their talents to various different teams. And we have we don't have infinite people, and that's just the problem we had to solve, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think one last point I'd like to make is that I have, and I know a lot of us have, a pretty deep and abiding respect for the guys at Obsidian, right? Avalon and his crew. Oh, yeah. They do some pretty amazing stuff, right? And you know, I think you could see at the end, too, kind of starting to, like, you could tell where it was time. It wasn't lack of inspiration. It certainly wasn't lack of ambition. And the thing I love is that the stuff they do is like our stuff, right? You know, at a glance, you're like, oh, that's very similar. But they have a very different focus, I think, and they have they have a penchant for the extreme that we don't necessarily. That you get some of the most memorable characters in gaming out of, right? You could see it all the way back into the Torment.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, this is the team behind Planescape. If you compare Planescape to Baldur's Gate 2, you can see the difference philosophy.
Yeah, we had a guy who had a hamster. They had a guy who was on fucking fire. You know, and you're just like, that's cool, right? And it's playing to different strengths, and it lets the medium explore and stagnate, and prevent stagnation, right? And every RPG studio, everyone who's telling stories in a digital medium is got valuable lessons for us to learn. We'd like to think that we throw a few curveballs for them to take a look at and go, oh, that was cool as well. And it's a constant evolution of mechanics and storytelling and character development and so on. And you need so many voices for that to not just turn into rote repetition. So I'm a huge fan of their work.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, people like to overlay a narrative of making the different companies enemies, you know, like, oh, they're the competition. It's you know, who wins? Like, well, we're playing their games too. Like, you know, it's not that kind of a, you know, it is competition because you raise your game. You literally raise your game to match, you know, to remain competitive and interesting. But that's awesome. You know, we need that kind of competition and that kind of iteration on our ideas, on their ideas, and back. And some of them you're going to love, and some of them you're not going to like, and that's just fine. Because another one of my pithy little sayings is if we all liked all the same games, that would only mean one thing: not enough fucking games. I want more games. I want games that do weird things that I just don't understand. I want, you know, it's.
Should play some of Alex Scott's simulator games. Sail a U-boat under the Atlantic.
I'm going to run across
battery power
France
in real time. It's going to take 6 months. Checking his big watch.
Last question in the back.
Okay, so popping around the BSN forums, you know, fans have all kinds of ideas all the time. And I'm wondering, as compared to like maybe a decade ago, how much of an impact does fan input have on a game now these days?
We definitely pay attention. We always have. Has it changed? Games are bigger. There's sort of slower moving, slower to turn.
So it's not that I would say that we take the input earlier now than we used to. It just takes a lot longer for you to see the change, just because of the nature of development.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of systematized feedback gathering. Try to make it more scientific. I mean, still largely, I think we run on nerd hunches to figure out what our product should be. But yeah, I mean, we actually go and get feedback and try and incorporate that at the earliest possible opportunity instead of just trying to react to it.
Yeah, it gets you out of your own head. I mean, we're all self-selecting bubbles of the people around us who like similar things, and that can cloud your vision, and it's good to get outside that. I like going onto Steam and playing the How Leet Am I game by checking my stuff against global achievements and saying, holy crap, I did what only 10% of people did. Maybe I should consider some of the stuff where that felt, maybe my assumptions about why that was awesome need to be looked at a little bit, because clearly not everyone's finding that cool thing or something. You know, it affects how you look at your own stuff and go, how do I make this appealing to people who sometimes don't even know what to ask for because they don't understand the guts underneath these things? So it's all useful.
One thing that's proven useful as well is just an understanding of where players tend to gravitate. One thing, you know, we do kind of an anonymous telemetry, so when you're playing the games, it'll feedback kind of info without tying it to you. So being able to look at our class distribution for Dragon Age, right? And, oh, geez, okay, you know, do people actually play rogues? Oh, yeah. Yeah, they do. Actually, quite a few of them, you know, and being able to understand that you know, okay, good, you know, in some cases, we almost gather that kind of feedback in order to I mean, you can catch some outliers, but every once in a while, someone will come along and just be like, why do you have female characters anyway? And, you know, there's some 90-year-old executive with a monocle and a crippling lack of awareness. And you'll be like, well, here's some charts. And they go, oh, very good. And you're like, damn, I'm glad we had that one lying around, you know. So, you know, do players actually play romance? Well, like 72%? Okay, then good. I guess we should probably keep doing those. So that's really useful info for us. It you know, in some cases it's validation of choices. Sometimes you see an outlier and you kind of have to ask yourself why. Though there is a point at which the nerd hunch is still a very powerful tool, right? You don't you focus testing and telemetry will never ever inspire. It will simply confirm or help you kind of understand something is wrong. But true inspiration kind of comes from the gut, I think.
Yeah, the telemetry and analytics team is under the online development team, which is the same team that is part of the community team. So, which is also part of the web team, which
that's a lot of teams.
Which did the keep, the same team that developed the keep. So we are one big happy family, fan feedback is really important to us, and if it doesn't get into the next game, it's you know, maybe future games. And something that is the majority is not necessarily going to resonate with the team. So, but it is listened to. And like I said, we do have a lot of those gut checks. Mike or Mike over at the end, pings me and says, hey, we think this is a cool idea. Do you think this will resonate with the fans? And sometimes it is simple IM conversations where I say, oh my gosh, yes, we just had a BSN thread exactly about that conversation. So we really are listening, and I know it sounds super cliche, but it is.
It sounds like archetypal.
It sounds archetypal.
Because I like it.
It is the smallest number of words in which I can say the truth, which Karen Weeks would say is just good editing. But yes, nice. We do listen.
Period.
Anything else you guys want to say about the 17 years of BioWare and Mark Dara's old shirt?
You don't all have to comment on my old shirt.
I'm shocked.
I will comment on my disapproval of everyone else's lack of an old shirt.
Yeah. I'm shocked it's held together this long, and I kind of mean that on both fronts. We're
the shirt's in better shape than my psyche.
Yeah, well, no, not you. The company. The thing is, we're this huge company. We've had this tremendous run, and I think again, coming in kind of, I guess, in the middle at this point, which seems so weird. When I came into BioWare, it was always this kind of chaotic system, right? It was not a highly controlled, regimented thing. I always assumed that there would be Gantt charts and all these crazy, time structure things. And while we've gotten a little better at that and we're crunching less, the thing that I love about it and have been so touched to see is that there's still a bit of that chaos bouncing around and that even a junior guy coming in with an idea can fling it to you. And it seems like we're really open and willing to accept that. And at that level, there's just enough chaos for us to keep maneuvering. And I think that that's probably my favorite part of working there for as long as I have.
When I was hired, I came home and told my then-girlfriend that I got hired, and she told her friends, and one of them said, "Oh, that'll never last." And for a lot of companies, it hasn't. There are a lot of tombstones of developers, and you have to look long term. You have to, it's astounding that we've been able to do this and continue to do this.
Well, it's thanks to these people.
Thanks to you.
Yes,
it's awesome.
My grandma still asks me when I'm going to get a real job.
So. Your grandmother's a wise woman.
Well, yeah. Anyone else?
I was just going to say I like the company and the people, and Ray Muzyka took a chance on me. He invested a schmo with a lot of responsibility. And I had to sleep under my desk for a year. And it was worth it. Yeah. Yeah, man. But we still do the same thing as we're not so high on ourselves that somebody can't come up with an idea. And we'll give people a shot. Give it a shot. Invest people with responsibility. This is a tremendously hard job, and I like keep injuring myself and breaking out in rashes and things. But it's also a really privileged, fun job. You get to sit around and make Dune jokes and get a latte.
You said it wasn't fun.
I said fun was overrated. Yeah. It's about accomplishment, right? So, working 4 years on Jade Empire, that was incredibly hard. And I don't know how I did it, but it was satisfying. I learned a lot of stuff.
But where else can you make a Dune joke and actually have people get it?
Yeah.
I like building up the next generation too, right? Like there are a lot of guys that we've hired, and we're the old salts, and we're mentoring people, and
you learn stuff.
Yeah, and having that openness and flatter hierarchy and the ability to challenge each other, that keeps it, it keeps you humble. Nobody sits on their laurels, and also you're helping other people have an awesome experience working in the game industry, and that feels good. That's a pretty good
absolutely
thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mike.
One last thing I will say that for me, and I think for a lot of people, we've discussed this, that coming to PAX, coming to a fan focusing, because for many, many years it was always the E3s and the Gamescom, just press, and they're cool. Press are cool, but you know what press don't do? They don't randomly erupt into applause and cheers. And you guys do that, and it is rejuvenating. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
All right.
And that brings us to the end of this episode's BioWare-based panel coverage. We hope you enjoyed listening.
Thank you so much. You can find us on Twitter @NerdAppropriate or Facebook/NerdAppropriate. Email us directly. That is Matt, Hillary with one L, Scott, or Ash @NerdAppropriate.com. And we have over 100 episodes to check out. So definitely subscribe and let us know what you think. Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone.